You have to do it, Jonathan said as they turned into Herodotium. Because he likes you. What makes you think that? Said Vivian. The dark wood around them was creaking and shifting. All he does is glare and growl and make fun of me. He only makes fun of people he likes, Jonathan said, and that won the argument. As they knocked at the door of Seldom End, Vivian agreed to do the asking. Their nerve failed as soon as they were inside. There, among the warm smell of wood and books, Dr. Willander sat in his hairy coat, lighting his pipe, and looking at them through the smoke with his small, clever eyes, as if he had never moved since they saw him last. Only the shabby purple gown flung over a pile of record cubes showed that Dr. Willander must have moved to take part in the ceremony.
"I'm doing the mind wars with you today," he snarled through the cloud of smoke. "Start attending. It's the most unpleasant episode there ever was in any fixed era. Its effects are felt all through the following unstable era, and go on to give rise to the Icelandic Empire. Consult your chart, Vivian, and tell me the main facts about the Mind Wars."
Vivian looked at her chart. She supposed she should start asking by saying innocently, "Dr. Willander, why is the ground shaking?" But she could not seem to feel it in here. It was impossible to think of anything except that Dr. Willander showed no signs of liking either of them. Hate and contempt seemed better words for the way he glared at her. "Before she does," Jonathan said, seeing that Vivian was in trouble, "she wants to ask you something."
Beast, thought Vivian. "Then she'd better speak for herself," Dr. Willander growled. "Go ahead, Vivian. You can use deaf and dumb language if it's more comfortable."
Making fun of me, Vivian thought. Does that really mean he likes me? She gulped. It's about that paper you gave me to translate. Why does it tell you where to find three of the caskets, but not the lead one?
I assume because the lesser caskets are attracted to the lead casket and will find it for you,
Dr. Willander grunted.
There is no point looking for the mind wars in the Stone Age. You will find them in 57th century.
Yes, but suppose that went wrong and someone had to find the lead casket, Vivian said. Have you any idea where Faberjohn put it?
We are not going to waste the afternoon playing Hunt the Slipper for legendary objects,
Dr. Willander retorted.
But while we're at it, tell me the meaning of Faberjohn's name.
Vivian sighed. Each time they had tried to ask Dr. Willander something, he had gone off on another tack. It did not seem worth trying any more. She was so annoyed that she quite forgot for the moment that she was supposed to be Vivian Lee. Smith, she said. It means boring old John Smith. This produced quite a lecture from Dr. Willander.
Boring, he said. Our founder's name, Boring, is the most honourable name there is. In the days when names began, the name Smith had to be earned. And you earned it by being the most gifted man in the area. The first Smith was a genius who found out how to work metal. People came to him for science and for magic. He wasn't just strong, if that's what you mean. He made things. And he knew how to put virtue in those things so that they would do their proper job. He dared to find out about such matters and to use his knowledge. But if you simply mean that Smith is a common name, you are saying that there are remarkably many gifted people in the human race, and that is not boring either. And now, consider the mind wars, please.
And they did. Vivian thought they were sickening. She had not realized such cruel things could be done to people's minds. Under attacks from various mind weapons, all the nations she knew about had disappeared for good, which upset her as much as the weapons. She had never been so glad to get away from the hot, wood-scented den in Seldom End. Jonathan, however, had clearly been thinking about something else the whole time. As they went down the quivering stairs, he said,
"If he's right about the other caskets attracting the lead one, then we've got to get the silver in order to find it."
Vivian said queasily,
"But the Silver Age is just after the Mind Wars."
"Yes, yes, I know,"
Jonathan said, dismissing this in his most lordly manner.
"But we're not going to get anywhere without it. Unless Elio's managed to find out more than we have, of course."
Chapter 14. The Age of Silver. Elio and Sam were waiting for them by the fountain in Time Close, where the water was all in criss-cross ripples from the shaking of the ground. Elio looked displeased. There was a frown on his smooth forehead, but it had nothing to do with the quaking of the earth.
"I have ransacked the records," he said, "and there is no sign of the things Leon Hardy knew. I wish I had not been so hasty in banishing him to Italy. Furthermore, the being who watches the gold casket is a complete fool."
"You mean you've been to the Age of Gold today?"
Jonathan said.
"I wish we'd seen you first," said Vivian. "The time ghost that climbs the steps to the gnomon is the Watcher of Gold."
"That is another thing I did not know," Elio said, frowning harder. "So he is bound to come here, whatever I said."
He seemed so upset that Vivian daringly patted his arm. It was nothing at all like touching the Iron Guardian. Elio's arm felt like an ordinary human arm.
"I think we'd better find the silver casket quickly," Jonathan said anxiously.
"Yes," Elio agreed. "We will go now."
They walked towards the palace, past the time ghost in ceremonial robes, who must have been a former sempiterne.
"My visit to the Age of Gold was a great waste of energy," Elio said. "There were wild persons in the trees, who made considerable efforts to kill me, and then an armed person on a horse who seemed to feel it his business to kill all of us. And when I gave him the slip and made my way to Lonansen, the Watcher stood chewing a piece of grass and refused to respond to any of my arguments. I had to leave hastily, anyway, for the person on the horse came back."
He sighed. As they went into the hall of the palace, he said,
"I hope we have better luck in the Age of Silver."
Nobody said anything. Vivian thought that if her own feelings were anything to go by, Jonathan and Sam must be hoping that something would stop them going there.
"Master Jonathan," said Elio, "you have not yet revealed whereabouts in the third unstable era Master Hardy told you to look for the silver casket."
Jonathan went lordly.
"Oh, haven't I?"
he said carelessly. They turned the corner into the gallery where the strong light made it plain that Jonathan was rather red.
"You rat!"
Sam cried out.
"You went without me again."
"That was where you disappeared to this morning," Vivian said.
"Master Jonathan, you took a grave risk,"
Elio said reprovingly.
"There is constant war in that era. Furthermore, you must have used the worn-out control, for I had the functional one with me all day."
"Yes, but I put it back in the hat," Jonathan said. "And there's no need to glare at me, Sam. I didn't find a thing. It was all salt desert with not a soul in sight. I thought I'd go to 100 years before the thief got there, you see, to make quite sure. But there wasn't any sign of any guardian, even when I shouted, and no way of telling where the casket was. It was a dead loss."
"And did the egg work properly?"
Vivian asked.
"No," said Jonathan. "When I tried to get back, it landed me in the Golden Age, quite near
Lonunson. And it was you I saw there, Elio. I thought it was, but you were running across the meadow so fast that I wasn't sure.
But it did take you back in the end, Vivian said.
Obviously, said Jonathan, or I wouldn't be here. But it took ages. And I only got back just before my parents left for the ceremony. I was quite scared.
Rightly, said Elio. This time, we will use my control. And we will go to 5 minutes before the thief reaches the casket, since it is clear that he had information which we have not and can lead us to the place. That is, Master Jonathan, if you will now be generous enough to tell us where to go.
It's in the Baltic Sea, Jonathan admitted. Leon said 64th century was the best time because the seas dry for 100 years on both sides of then.
And he told them a map reference which meant nothing to Vivian. Elio seemed to understand. He looked dubious.
I hope Master Hardy told you right, he said. There is certainly a war zone in that century, however history runs. And as I told you, I found that era very disturbed. However, he added, looking more cheerful, I shall be there to make sure you are safe. And I have taken care to provide us all with protective clothing. This way.
He led the way towards the display cases at the far end of the gallery. Vivian stopped in front of the one that held her own luggage. It looked dusty and foreign to her now, and not at all useful.
Elio, she said, if we do get the silver casket, and Time City's all right, I'm going to need this for when I go home.
Elio stopped, with his head twisted round, staring at the luggage with obvious regret.
I have never had anything from 20th century before, he said. But, of course, you must have it when you need it.
Vivian could tell that it cost him a real wrench to say it.
But it is mine, she thought,
as Elio went on to the case that held the Martian boots. There were now 4 flat silver packets in it instead. The label said, 24th century nylon stockings, for men. Elio opened the case, took the packets out, and turned the label over. That side read, display removed for repairs. He handed them a packet each, as he led the way to the chained door. Vivian's stomach wobbled, and seemed to wobble worse every step of the way down to the underground room. Her fingers shook when she opened her packet by Elio's belt light.
Odd-shaped, filmy silver cloth spilled out.
These are mine shield suits from 56th century, Elio told them. I procured them from then, because mind war suits have never been bettered. Put them on over your heads and faces, and let the rest spill down to your feet.
Why does it have to go all over?
Asked Sam.
My mind's in my head.
Ah, but there are nerves all over your body that lead to your head. A mind warrior only has to find an unprotected nerve,
Elio explained.
These suits will stop that. They will also stop other weapons to some extent, provided you are not at close range.
This made Vivian feel more wobbly than ever. It did not help to feel the ground still shaking slightly, even down here. She pulled the strange cloth over her head. It was easy to breathe through, and it fell across her shoulders and down over the rest of her with the gentlest of touches. She spread her arms to look down at herself, all covered in flowing silvery folds. We're not going to be able to walk far trailing round in this stuff, she thought. But after a pause, in which the cloth must have been adjusting to her, it suddenly shrank around her.
Lift your feet, one after the other, Elio said.
Vivian did so, and the silvery stuff promptly shrank itself round the underside of each of her shoes. And she was wearing an all-over suit of filmy silver. The others were silver all over, too. Sam's face and Jonathan's looked at her through the film, squashed and whitish.
"I can't see too well," Jonathan said. "It seems to be cancelling out my optical function."
"Then keep close to me," said Elio. The belt light, coming from under his suit, made him look like a luminous ghost.
"You must all keep close to me. I shall do my utmost to ensure our safety, and as you are aware, my utmost is more than twice that of a born human."
He raised his hand with a red, egg-shaped control in it, filmy under the suit, and pointed it at the flickering slate. The slate vanished into a door opening on dazzling brightness. White, white sand stretched away to a distant, pale blue sky. They stepped through it, and their suited feet crunched and slipped on what felt like frost. Probably it's salt from the dried-up sea, Vivian thought. But the place felt cold, too. Her suit did not do much to stop a keen, icy wind. She turned her head away from the wind and the white glare, and realized that the white land was not a level desert at all. Blue shadows showed that it was a mass of hummocks and holes. Some of them were regular-looking ditches that reminded Vivian of the trenches in World War I. Jonathan's eye function had darkened in the glare. He turned his face rather blindly from side to side.
"What's happened? It was flat when I came here this morning."
"Someone's dug a lot of holes," Sam told him.
A voice spoke. It rapped out words in a foreign language from overhead.
"Down,"
said Elio, and threw himself flat on the white ground. They all threw themselves down beside him. The whiteness was icy cold. The place where Vivian fell turned out to be on a slope, so that she rolled as she went down, and then slid. She ended flat on her back, some way from the others, staring into the cloudless sky. The sky almost above her was filled by a half-transparent thing like a raft which was floating in the air about 50 feet up. Leon Hardy told us wrong, she thought. He meant us to get killed. She did not dare move. The raft was bluish, and she could see the bottoms of people's feet through it. The faces of the people were peering down through paler bubbles at the edges of the raft. They were blank, squashed faces covered in something yellowish, which must have been mine suits, rather like her own. The voice rapped out again, and the raft fired on them. Whatever it was came down in whitish ripples. Vivian screamed. For just an instant, before her suit cancelled the weapon out, something seemed to be tearing the inside of her head away. Then she just lay and watched the white ripples and hoped that the other suits were working properly too. The firing stopped, but not because the people in the raft had finished. Another craft, a slightly greenish one, was coming in from higher up to attack the first one, moving very fast with a small whistle of wind. The first raft rose another 50 feet and sheered away sideways. As soon as it moved, Vivian saw a third raft, different again, with a mauve tinge, plummeting out of the high sky at the first two. Both the lower rafts shot away sideways, and then shot back again to attack the mauve one. They circled the sky, all three, up and down and around one another, fighting furiously without any sound except the thin whistling of the wind. Vivian had never imagined this kind of warfare. Since it was not aimed at her, her suit did not block very much of it out. Ripples sped sideways across her, bringing calm voices of madness, giggles of rage, hymns of nastiness, screams of exhaustion, tinkles of death, whistles of despair, and loud songs of horror. And none of it made a sound. Vivian had to lie on the cold ground and bear it in all its back-to-front wrongness. Then in the part of the sky which she could see between her own silvery feet, Vivian noticed a cloud of blue-grey smoke. It drifted nearer, fast and high, streaming this way and that, and groping about as if it was looking for something, until it located the three fighting rafts. Then it came snaking in, grabbing for them like some enormous greyish glove. All three rafts tried frantically to get out of its way. One hurtled straight up into the air, and a man fell off it. Vivian heard him give a real scream as he crashed to the ground. The second raft went low and hurtled past a few feet above Vivian, wobbling and weaving and spraying out ripples as if something was wrong with it. The last raft put on speed and raced away in the opposite direction. The cloud dived round and went after it. 2 seconds later, the blue sky and the glittering white desert were completely empty. Sam rolled over on the slope above Vivian.
"How many sides are there in this war?" he said.
"Time alone knows," said Jonathan, crawling to his hands and knees.
"That was nasty."
He stood up, shivering. Vivian got up with her teeth chattering and helped Sam to his feet. Elio was the last to stand up. He raised himself slowly and painfully, and to their horror, most of the suit under his right arm had gone blue and melted-looking.
"It is nothing," he said. "Just something from that low-flying raft. I am all right. I was made to withstand adversity. Let us find that casket before any more warriors appear."
He tore open his suit on the side opposite to the melted blueness and fetched out a small gleaming gadget. The suit sealed itself up behind it. Sam forgot his fright.
"Hey," he said, "there's a 110th century metal detector. My dad's got one. He says you can't get one for love nor money these days. How did you get hold of it? Can I work it?"
Sam got his way because Elio was limping and swaying, and Jonathan was stumbling about with his hands out like a sleepwalker. With his eye function dark in the glare, and the veil of the suit in front of it, he could barely see at all. He switched it off disgustedly in the end. Sam confidently turned the metal detector to detect silver, and went stumping off in widening circles.
"My dad says there's nothing to beat these," he called out. "You can find needles in haystacks. Keep close. It's showing something already."
They tried to keep up with Sam as he tramped off in the direction the cloud had come from, but it was hard going. The salty sand was a mass of holes and frozen hummocks, ditches and mounds. One moment they would be sliding down a glittering slope, and the next they would be having to jump a deep blue trench. Vivian had to help Jonathan most of the time. She tried to help Elio too, but he waved her away.
"I'm fine," he panted. "My efficiency is in no way impaired."
Vivian did not believe him. Elio's face, mistily showing through the suit, seemed to be twisted with pain. What will Sempertan Walker do if Elio's badly hurt, she was wondering, when Sam pointed the detector at the side of the tall white mound ahead, and it gave out a strong, clear, cheeping sound.
"Got it!"
Sam bawled.
"It's here! Did you bring something to dig with, Elio?"
"You won't need to do any digging," said a soft voice from the top of the mound.
Their heads all jerked up to look at the silvery person standing there. It was a woman, as far as they could see. She was not easy to see because she seemed to be made of masses and masses of trailing silvery whiteness. All in silver, Vivian thought, which befits an age where men create and kill in marvellous ways. She's made of layers of mind suit. Under the silvery layers, Vivian could just pick out what seemed to be a lovely face.
"Are you the guardian of the silver casket?"
Sam asked.
"That is right," said the woman.
Her voice had a lilt to it, or a trace of a foreign accent. Vivian could just see very red lips move smilingly, as the guardian said,
"And why do you come seeking me and my casket 2 days before the proper time?"
"A thief is trying to steal it, madam," Elio said. His voice sounded forced and scratchy. Vivian was sure he was in a lot of pain. "This will bring about the destruction of Time City, and possibly also render all history violently unstable. We therefore think you should take the casket to the safety of Time City at once, where it will enable us to discover the mechanism of all the other caskets, particularly the lead." Jonathan was shading his eyes with both hands in an effort to see the guardian.
"We need it urgently," he said. "You see, we think the caskets attract one another, and if they do, the silver will help us to find the lead before it's too late to do any good."
"You do not have the lead casket?" said the guardian. She sounded quite surprised.
"Not yet, madam, but we know it is in Time City," Elio said.
"The lead casket is in Time City," the guardian declared. Her voice rang out strong and comforting. "It can be found by using the silver to attract it. Very well. As you need the silver so badly, I will break the injunctions that were laid on me and give you the casket now."
And to their great relief and surprise, her hand came forward among the floating draperies around her, a long silvery hand, holding a large, shiny, egg-shaped thing. As Elio hobbled awkwardly up the mound and took the casket, Vivian saw that it was wonderfully ornamented, in lacy shapes. She was rather ashamed that it reminded her so much of an Easter egg. But she forgot that the next moment. A white flash of movement caught the corner of her eye. She looked round just in time to see a small, silvery figure slide along the blue shadow of a nearby ditch and scramble among the hummocks beyond.
"The thief!"
she yelled, and dashed off after him. As she raced along the ditch and leapt among the hummocks, someone screamed,
"Vivian!"
after her. She took no notice. She had the silver figure in sight now, with the sun glinting off it. The boy was running for his life across the uneven ground, and she knew she could run faster than he could. She had nearly caught him last time. He had somehow got himself a mind suit, but he was not carrying the iron casket, and Vivian was sure that this meant he would not be able to escape by time-travelling this time. "It's the caskets that time-travel," she thought in a surge of understanding. Her frozen feet warmed up, and the cold air hurt in her chest. She shut her mouth and pelted joyfully across the jumbled, pitted ground. The thief glanced round, saw that she was gaining, and swerved away desperately. Then the ground gave way under Vivian. Something the same colour as the white sand tore under her running feet, and then came apart all around her with a soggy, ripping noise. She was pitching down into a deep hole. Much to her own surprise, her finger went to the low weight stud on the belt under the mine suit and pressed it in time to save her from breaking a bone. She went light as she hit the grey rocks at the bottom of the hole, and bounced, and came down again, where she lay staring up at a torn shape of blue sky high above.
"Oh, bother and damn!" she said.
The thief had tricked her and got away again.
"Are you badly hurt?" someone asked.
It was a man's voice, but it was high and quavering and nervous. Vivian lay quite still and turned her eyes carefully sideways. There was a mind warrior in a silver suit like her own, huddled at the other side of the hole. She remembered the man who had fallen screaming out of the raft. "I shall pretend to be dead," she decided. "Perhaps he'll climb out and go away."
"I ask because I had some skill in healing once," the warrior said in his nervous, fluting voice.
When Vivian did not answer, he sighed loudly.
You may not believe this, but I am quite peaceful, he said. I was a lover of all arts before this terrible war began. I painted pictures and made music. I even wrote an epic once.
Vivian went on lying still and tried to let her eyes fall gently shut. I'm dead, she thought. My last word was damn. The warrior sighed again.
Perhaps it will convince you that I am harmless, he said, if I were to recite you my poem. It is in 12 parts in the ancient manner, and its title is The Silver Sea. The opening line is, Mind and the men I sing. This because it celebrates the great civilization that once flourished around the shores of this sea. Do you follow me? Shall I recite?